It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Some very beautiful non-traditional homes have been made out of older structures in Iowa. Barns, schools, churches. And of course, we also have a lot of really old houses in need of updating. This hour, we're going to talk about updating and repurposing old structures with Bill McAnally, our home improvement expert. Hello, Bill.
Good morning.
Thank
How are you?
Oh, I'm great. Thank you so much for being here today. And first of all of these old structures, and you can drive through the countryside and you can look at this barn and you think, that is a beautiful old barn.
Oh, but boy.
You can also see through the barn and, you know, the foundation doesn't look so good. It's falling apart. How bad does it have to be before a structure can't be saved?
It just depends how much money you've got. That's all it comes down to. You know, we still have some really cool barns out there, and I've seen some take corn cribs as well. You know, there's a few that have gone to the extreme of taking the metal grain bins.
Mm-hmm.
That's a little too far out there for me. Looks like a stubby rocket ship, you know, and with the door on the side.
Yeah, but pretty cool. And I know there's some bed and breakfasts out there with the grain bin.
Yeah, I have a friend that builds those. So that's why I'm saying it. So hopefully he's listening.
All right.
No, you know, there's still in some parts of Iowa where luckily, especially like, you know, these century farms where they've really kept up with upgrading and, you know, keeping a good roof on their older structures. They haven't let them, you know, just go to pot. Some of these older barns, especially the ones, you know, like in Northeast Iowa, I think there's probably a few more of them that have been kept up for some reason. But some of them are made of the native oak. Some are even some red elms that were good then. But there was one down by Lehigh that was all walnut, and it was all mortise and tenon, big timber frame with wooden pegs, and it ended up getting burned down.
Oh.
And I was just thinking, you know, if those people knew when they burned it how much it would be worth today to somebody on the East or West Coast, they'd probably pay a farm off. You know, really all we have to do is if you drive down the road and you see one that's well painted, you know, it has kept up with maybe their family scheme, whether it's red or white or whatever, and you look at the roof at the top, and if it has a sway on the top of it, oh, okay, you know, we're going to have to do some straightening and things like that, and look at the bottom of the barn. If that was used maybe, you know, in the 70s or so, they may be using it for hogs, and then they would just get that whole bottom area saturated with moisture. And I've taken some old, I really like using repurposed lumber, you know, tearing down buildings. I used to take down a lot of corn cribs and that, and use the lumber for projects. But when you take the bottom or the bottom part of, say, maybe a stud, the bottom 2 feet, or some of the planks that were close to where the animals are, they'll pick that odor up. And I don't care how much you plane or sand, it's still there. And I just had that with an issue this winter, a white 2x12, beautiful paint job on it. I started taking some of the paint off, and here came that hog odor.
Oh.
And I said, you know, I can't get rid of it. You know, those are some considerations, but you can usually straighten a barn up. And there's some companies, you know, especially in Minnesota and Wisconsin, Iowa, that do barn straightening or building straightening. They can bring them back. Because they don't have like plaster on the inside of the house.
Right, it's not going to crumble.
No.
But so I think what I'm hearing you saying is if the bones are good, the rafters and the posts.
Right. And what a lot of people will do is they want to save that character. And so what they'll do is they'll take the existing siding off and just leave that frame and then build on the outside of it. So really all you're doing is building a new home around that barn so you could see the timber frame structure.
Okay. Now, we've talked in the past about renovating old homes, and I think that you are one of the people who has said, you know, the greenest structure is the existing structure.
Right.
Starting from scratch, even if you're going to build with all the latest technology and all the greenest techniques, mm-hmm. is still less environmentally friendly than starting with something older. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, because, you know, if people want to look at the carbon units and that's already there. Everything is captured. There's no more, say, intrinsic energy of traveling and delivering and manufacturing. It's all right there. So all you need to do, you know, like it's a little thing, you know, is to bring it up to, you know, building standards and minimum, if nothing else, minimum, you know, housing standards. The biggest key that the problem we have here in Iowa is, you know, if the inside is exactly the way you like it, you know, you've got maybe old lumber and you don't mind the floors maybe sagged a little bit and all the doors have been trimmed, you know, so that they actually close and shut.
Right. If you can't swap out any old door.
Yeah, whatever, you know. they have that character and you love the house the way it looks. You love the color of the trim. You like the plaster that's in there and you've kept up with it. And somebody will say, well, okay, let's do a deep energy retrofit on this. Let's really make this so it's energy efficient. Okay, are we going to do it from the inside or the outside? If we do it from the inside, the character is going to be gone because you're going to have to rip all the outside off to do it correct. I mean, in my opinion, do it correctly because you have to examine the bones of that house to see if it is worth. You know, it might look nice, but you don't know what's in there till you tear it apart. You know, an older home's going to have the wiring brought up, you know, to speed. And so do you need to pull all that trim off and all the doors and replace all the windows? Then you're back to, okay, we've just got a framework now, and we've just thrown in some brand-new windows and new trim. Really, what did you gain? Now you've got a new-looking house.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why a lot of energy efficiency, you know, people are doing it all from the outside. One of the big advantages is that people get to keep the character of the house on the inside, and they can stay in the house while the work's going on. And you can expose everything on the outside. If you do it, you know, you either put a temporary enclosure around that part of the house you're working on or, you know, do it again certain part of the year. But you could pull the exterior sheeting off and siding off and do even the wiring from the outside, re-insulate it, air seal it from there, and put on a nice facade on the outside. The downside is if you've got an old, maybe a Victorian with all of that, you know, artisan style woodwork, how are you going to take that off, put it
right
back on? And then those costs start ramping up.
So maybe with the old four squares on the farmsteads, it's a little bit easier because
easier.
They're simpler.
They are, because I've been working the past few years with Iowa Economic Development Authority and BNIM Architects out of Des Moines on projects trying to get deep energy efficient retrofits. And we're having a real problem because by the time you look at this old house, we've looked at quite a few of them in Iowa, by the time you bring it to minimum housing standards, you have very little budget left to do the energy efficiency side of it. And it's just a catch-22. So because when you do all that work, now how much do you have in the house? Will you ever be able to get that out? If you look at the financial side, you know, let's say we put $60,000, $70,000 in a house to bring it up, and what they paid for it originally in this neighborhood, which maybe many of the houses aren't brought up to speed, would you ever be able to get that money back? In many cases, no. And so you have to look at it as, this is my life home, or is this an investment? That's where the decisions have to be made. And I think a lot of these homes should be brought up to where they were before, because I think we need to keep the character of the community. Not just, you know, everybody's always talking about affordable housing. And it's funny, when I went out and did some presentations this year, I would ask each group, what do you think is an affordable home? One group said $250,000. One group said $150,000. One said $275,000. I mean, it's all over the place. And to me, I think the top of the range is $180,000. Anything over that, I don't think, to me, that wouldn't be classified as an affordable first home or last home. And it's really hard in many cases to build a home for that. So most new homes, you know, in Iowa, are around $250,000. But is that affordable?
Getting back to really repurposing or renovating these old structures, I want to, before we run out of time,
sure,
talk about foundations.
Yeah.
Because, with many old houses, definitely with outbuildings, with right. barns, you have sometimes some cobbled together foundations. Oh, so yes. tell me how you assess that and decide well, what you can do about it.
That brings up an exact case. A friend of mine over by Lytton, she had, it was like, it was a century farm. It's a family farm. And the house was cool, but the foundation was just garbage. And we got, you know, we were a past student of mine's there, and I'm there, and the family's there. So what do we do? Well, you can patch it. You know, you can lift the house up, put a new foundation in. In the end, they decided to go with a company that, you know, these foundation companies that are advertised all the time on TV, with one of those companies, and they straightened the foundation and reinforced it and put a very nice waterproofing system on it. Now, it was a lot of money, but it was well worth it. It was a very good investment because the house is beautiful. You couldn't build that house for $400,000 if you wanted to build it like that, because it was a beautiful farmhouse from the, you know, early 1900s.
And by investing in the foundation, I mean, they made that so the house
yes.
could stand for another 150 years.
No sense putting any money in that house if it's got a bad foundation. I'm glad you brought that up, because many people do. They do the foundation last and they find out, oh my gosh, you know, this wasn't worth it.
Right. And in repurposing a building, like let's say you're going to take a barn, I mean, that would be where you would start, because the
yes.
the kind of foundation that's put into a barn for the most part
no.
would not be something that could be part of a home.
No, it wouldn't, because, you know, it was lumber that it was old growth lumber sitting on concrete, sitting on wet soil.
Or a pile of rocks.
Yeah, a pile of rocks. They're hard to bust up, but but no, you lift that up, and a lot of times you would cut off, you know, like a couple feet and rebuild the whole thing from the bottom. But no, that if that foundation isn't up to speed, and no sense even, I mean, that's a big percentage of what your investment's going
to
be.
And if you have to lift it to build a new foundation, is it more difficult to move it on the property a little bit, or?
Not really.
No,
not really, because the movers that we have in Iowa, I mean, there's a couple of them here that, okay, it's no big deal. You know, I think it's a big deal. They just lift it up and on these beams, and they'll slip it off to the side. I did one years ago where we moved it from one town and moved it out to an airport. And I thought it was going to be a big deal. And the biggest deal was writing the checks every time you cross the highway or cross a railroad, or have, you know, the power company raise
the
lines.
Right?
Yes.
Yep.
You know, that was the biggest hassle.
All right. Well, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back. We will answer your questions. But if you have questions about reusing, repurposing old buildings, of course, Bill would love to answer those
yes.
questions. But he'll answer questions about anything you've got on your to-do list. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, the phone number is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Bill McAnally, our home improvement expert, is here today, and he's here to answer your questions. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we are going to get to your calls in just a second. I have a pop quiz for you, Bill.
What's the most popular Pink Floyd song?
No.
Oh, okay. All right. Move along.
But as I, you know, all my life, as I've driven around Iowa, I see these old structures, many that are abandoned, that I think, ooh, if only
yep.
I could
mm-hmm.
bring that back from the brink. Is there a structure that you dream about? Is there a particular kind of structure that really sets your imagination on fire?
Yes, an old timber frame barn.
All right.
Yeah. Oh man. I just, yeah, die and go to heaven if you had a timber frame, oak or walnut timber frame. And oh, yeah. Yeah. I took a timber framing class up in northern Minnesota one year. And after doing that, you're just, boy, if I could just find one. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Let's go to the phones. Julie is on the line in Elkader. Hi, Julie.
Well, hi there. How are you?
Great.
How are folks today?
Great. And
super.
You repurposed an old building. Tell us about it.
I certainly did. I bought the Clayton County Jail. It was originally built in 1870. And I bought it in the end of 06, repurposed it, tried to bring it back to its original glory, but also did some beautiful amenities. So now it's our home and a bed and breakfast.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I bet on the wall there's a McAnally scratch somewhere in that jail etched in the stone. I just know there is.
Well, there are some pretty interesting carvings in there, let me tell you. But what's really interesting is The walls are built of limestone, 24 inches thick, and it was quarried real close to El Cater. I think it was called Lover's Leap. And you can see where they had the indentions, and they had, like, the ice hooks, the pulley system,
yeah,
where the horses would, you know, put that each stone in place. So it has a lot of very cool history.
Yeah, that's neat.
That is very cool. And you have a question about it, too?
Well, you know, I just had a comment saying, you know, for the love of old structures, do whatever you can to keep them alive and repurpose them. And I love this, you know, what you're talking about today, and I thank you so much for that.
All right. Well, thank you, Julie. Sounds like you've done some very interesting work. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. If you've got a story like that to share, we would love to hear it. I know a lot of people are living in old one-room schoolhouses, and so many of those small rural churches have been abandoned over the years. They can make really incredible homes as well. Back to some more modern questions here. This one's from David. He says, I was considering digging a footing for a retaining wall next to a city sidewalk. Will this cause problems with the city sidewalk? Is there something special I should do? The wall will be fieldstone 2 to 3 feet high.
Well, first of all, you better get with the city, and they'll tell you right off the bat, no uncertain terms, how they want that done.
Right. Don't make plans before you talk to them, right?
You know, that's always, and I don't know, that's just been a pet peeve of mine is somehow, you know, that's our property, but yet we're always told how to do it. I don't know why that bothers me, but it always has. But yeah, you better get with the city because, you know, every city is different. Some will not let you get within so many feet of a sidewalk to do any disturbance. Not to mention, you know, you're going to have to make sure and do your one call to make sure that you don't have anything coming in shallow, because we ran into one instance this in the past, is there had been a lot of construction work that nobody really knew about on a particular street. I was running the backhoe digging down when we were actually putting a driveway in, and there was a 6-inch gas main that was located, but they're supposed to be down, you know, in the ground a little ways. But they had, nobody had kept track at one time, but when they worked on a lot, they skimmed off a bunch of the dirt, and this thing was only down about 18 inches. And so when I just tapped on something, I thought, well, it must be a rock. And luckily we stopped. And so you never know. You know, you do need to have it located. And remember that whenever they do the locates, that you need to have kind of a buffer, you know, around and up and down. But, yeah, you'd better get with the city on that because – there may be an issue of what the sidewalk is sitting on. If you have real, like, sandy soil or real cavey type soil, if you excavate maybe even within a foot, it may fall out from underneath the sidewalk, and then they're going to require you to come back and bring the soil back to a certain density underneath the sidewalk. So it could be a real big can of worms. So you want to get them involved right away and check with them, and because they may not allow that in your community.
All right. This is a question from Dave in Donaldson. He says, we have a 100-year-old farmhouse, and of course the floor is sagging in the center of the house. I've been trying to slowly jack up the floor using basement screw supports, and I've hit a snag not far from the chimney. I can't budge the floor anymore. In your experience, Bill, are the floor joists ever connected to the chimney in some way?
Yeah, they're not supposed to be, but in some cases they were. They, because, you know, you can hardly tell. We don't know who built it.
Right. And a lot of these houses weren't really built with plans.
They weren't.
This will work.
It kind of the shade tree carpenter kind of thing. They may have to help hold the floor when they're originally working on it. Maybe put, you know, the floor joist or a beam or something into the chimney just to hold it, maybe while they were building, not in, you know, thinking about down the road something may settle. So if you can get access to look in there, and if you can't get access, at least get a hole. And some of these newer, they have these, you know, cameras that they used to use them for looking inside engines. You know, you can buy them at at most big box stores for about $30 now. It's got a little screen, and it has a flexible end on it that goes sometimes up to 2 feet with a camera on the end that if you could just stick it through a hole and take a look and see without tearing a lot of things apart. But yes, I could easily see someone sticking something into the chimney, and then you sit back and wonder, why hasn't this place burned down?
Yeah.
But in a lot of cases, the reason it hasn't is the bottom of the chimney was just being used, you know, the bottom 8 feet in the basement was used as an ash pit. And so the actual fire was above that. But still, you just wonder why it hasn't happened. But yes, that could easily happen. So I would not, once you've hit this snag, I wouldn't try to force it because you could cause damage to the chimney. And since we don't know how well that is built, that could be catastrophic as well because it could tip. And then the whole thing would drop down like a piston inside of a sleeve.
Oh, wow.
that's an image that you just
nobody
wants. You wouldn't want to be sitting there and see it just disappear.
Oh man. Okay. Well, good luck, Dave.
Yep.
Let's go back to the phones. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. John is on the line in Ankeny. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I wanted to ask about the ratings on can lights in the ceiling, the recessed ones.
Yes.
They'll have like a maximum wattage of like 65 watts.
Right.
And my problem is that the kitchen just wasn't quite bright enough. So I went out and started with CFLs, and now they're LEDs.
Right.
And increased what they, now they say they're like a 100 or 120 watt equivalent.
Right.
When it says a maximum wattage, I assume that they meant the real watts, not that watt equivalency.
Right, right. Yeah, and the other thing is, you know, the old incandescents, you know, gave off a lot of heat. And that's what they're really worried about. These new LEDs, you know, you might even put in, let's say, 100, and it has, a 30-watt equivalent. It's not giving off any heat, so you can go up in the wattage. They're looking at the heat. Put off by it. And then, you know, the thing is, too, is, you know, especially in a kitchen, we just put some in ours and some friends did, too, is, you know, look at that brightness, you know, bar across there, whether you want the warm, which is more of a yellow to the left, which is like lower, like, say, 2,000, 2,500 Kelvin. I really like the bright when you get up there around 5,000 and a lot of people do in bathrooms over a vanity and in the kitchen for any task area. But, you know, just to make sure on that, I would, you know, wherever you buy the lights, you know, just double check with them and maybe do a little bit more research. But everybody that I know of goes by, you know, that 35 equivalent would more
they,
than fine.
They go by the actual watts, the number of watts that it actually uses,
right.
Not what it's a 100-watt equivalent.
Right, right. They go by actually what it, yeah, yep.
Okay.
So
that's
safe.
What I was
I
doing.
Mean,
I just wanted to make sure I was right.
Yeah, and I tell you what's really nice now with the LEDs, you know, when you're wiring, it seems like, you know, before you could only put so many of these, you know, 100-watt light bulbs on a circuit, and you could pretty much do a whole basement, you know, since it's LEDs because they don't draw anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really nice. And if you're looking at can lights, you know, look at those surface mounted ones like a Luminaire brand or whatever, you know, they just go into a regular box so you don't have to have the cans anymore.
Right.
Those are pretty nice.
Thank you.
You bet.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, John. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Steve is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Steve.
Hello. Good morning, Charity and Mr. McAnally.
Oh, thanks. Mr., do you hear that, Charity?
I heard it.
So I've got it's a Century Farm. And we used to do dairy, and then we got out of dairy about like 8-10 years ago. And so there's a 80-foot silo, Rochester silo, that we're not using anymore. And it's a really nice tower, and I'd like to make it into something that's usable for like a space to like, you know, hang out or something like that.
Sure.
Have you ever seen anything like that or seen any around?
I haven't seen any in Iowa. I think there was one either on Fine Home Building a few years ago. You know what I'd do is I'd get on Pinterest, and you'd be able to pull one up, I'm sure, because that, you know, that's all over the world. And I would put silo homes.
So is
it'll
it
probably be a missile silo your first one it comes
is it
up.
Is it brick or is it what's it made out of?
It was built in the 80s, so it's like it's cement block.
Right, with the bars around the exterior.
With the bars, these bands around it. And it's probably like 10, 15 feet across it.
Oh, man, that would be so cool. Yeah. Well, I'd rig up, told to do this, but I would rig up like a winch at the bottom, have a little elevator go all the way to the top, you know? Oh, you could really have fun.
That would be pretty fun.
Yeah.
It'd be a lot easier than climbing it, I'm sure. It would be easier than climbing it. So.
You could also become a tourist attraction if you started to do that ice climbing thing on your silo.
Oh, yeah, just spray, like leave a hose on top of there.
Last
year at this time, we would have gotten a pretty thick wall last year.
It's true.
Could take your green bin fan, put it facing up, and then have those little parachute little guys floating around in there. Oh, man, I tell you what, this is endless. Gee, Steve, this is going to be great.
All right. I'll call back when it's done.
Yes.
Oh, do. We want to know what you do with it. Thanks a lot for your call, Steve. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. Diane, and what do you want to say?
See, I'm too fat. I'd be laying on the fan, and they just wouldn't get enough wattage or CFM. Come on, Bill, get up there. So then they'd have to hook me up to the elevator and pull me up, like make me think I'm in a fan.
You've got
This is great. I'm going to think about this all the way home.
All right. Diane in Iowa City says, I'm getting cold air entering my kitchen through my recently installed micro vent hood. How do I stop it? It's vented to the outside.
Yes, somebody put the wrong hood on for the microwave. There's supposed to be a hood with a damper. Now, they may have put the correct hood on, but some of them, the less expensive ones, when warm air comes from through the vent, pulls it from the room. If it's really cold outside, it gets enough condensation on it, and then it freezes it. And you might have to run the fan, some cases, a few minutes before you get enough warm in there to melt it and then open it back up. But it's not shutting. And probably when it's windy, you hear the rattling. In some cases, with some people, when somebody opens the door to the house, you'll hear it flap. Get with the people that installed it and see if they can put an inline damper in that. But they do have to come back and take a look at it because
you shouldn't be getting a breeze.
No, you should not get any breeze. And some of the companies, if it's brand new, will not honor the warranty because bringing cold air in from outside can affect, get condensation into the unit itself, and your warranty will be gone. So you need to get them back right away and get that repaired.
All right. This is a great question from Craig in Des Moines. He says, before I buy and refinish a portable parquet dance floor, can you advise me about whether I can trim it and install it as a permanent kitchen floor and what I should be concerned about, if it's even possible?
You could put it in as a permanent kitchen floor. If it's depends on the thickness, too, because some of the parquets are only like 3/8 thick.
Mm.
And so if
they're
you're going to
so
refinish
beautiful.
It doesn't leave a whole lot, but boy, it's beautiful wood. I tell you what, the only problem in a kitchen sometimes is the wear patterns, because you're with the cabinets, and if it's an island or something, and the way you go through, your travel patterns on the floor are minimized. It doesn't cover a whole area, so you got a real narrow wear pattern, and I don't know what kind of finish they'll put on it. The biggest thing here was to make sure that the floor was properly prepped with what the manufacturer would recommend for the parquet, but really get on them about what kind of a finish, because some of the finishes that hold up very well have a tendency to wear the heck out of your socks. I mean, they have like a real, almost like a sandpaper finish, so people don't slip, but then a lot of people like to just walk in their socks all the time, and it wears that out very fast. So, you know, that get to that finish, you're going to have to really do some research on what you like. But I think it'd make it beautiful.
Right. But you're saying it might be too thin, because if you want to refinish it however you want to refinish it, but if it's too thin.
So there should be, you know, somewhere in the room, there should be like a floor vent coming from the heating. You know, lift the grill up and you can see how thick that flooring is, or where it butts up against the wall, pull some trim up. If it's 3/8, somebody may have already done it once, and then you're getting down to where it's usually some of the brands are a tongue and groove. It may get to a case where now if you put any weight on it, it are going to split, and then you may get slivers. So, yeah, you know, take a look and see how thick it is, and take it to a flooring refinishing person first and ask them, is it going to be worth it, and how many more times can I refinish it if I have to?
All right, because you want it to last forever.
Yes, yes, you do.
All right, we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is here today. We started out focusing on repurposing and renovating old structures into homes or whatever you want them for. And, of course, we'll take your questions about that, but we'll also take your questions about anything you've got on your home improvement to-do list. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is here today to answer your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We've got some great questions about repurposing old structures. Here's one from... Well, I'll have to follow up on this later, he says, but this is from Nate. There's an old timber frame barn on my mom's farm. The frames are in good shape, but the foundation and exterior needs work. Ooh. If we fix it, we don't know how we'd use it.
So. Oh, if it is a timber frame and you don't want to, say, repurpose it, they're worth some money to the right people. There's a show that we watch sometimes, you know, where these guys are repurposing barns, tearing them down. And some of them, especially if it's oak or walnut, and they are mortise and tenon together and they have all the joints and wooden pegs, you know, you start doing some research and you'll find somebody that if you want to sell it that may give you a fair amount of money. But they can be taken apart if you know how to do it correctly. Or redo the outside and make them valid again. But there again, you know, you could just put a new foundation up, because the nice thing is they're not super heavy. You know, if you know how to lift them up and get them squared up, it's, you know, pretty easy to put a new foundation in underneath them.
All right.
You don't want, whatever you do, don't burn it or tear it down and throw it away. Please don't do that.
All right. Lee is on the line in Marshalltown. Hi, Lee.
I was wondering about these contractors that come, and they've got 200 homes under their belt. You get a building permit, get a contract, and $300,000 later, they walk off the job, unfinished, paying subcontractors.
Yeah.
State of Iowa, you have 45 days that a contractor can sue you. Then you have to go sue the general contractor.
Yeah.
Then
yeah.
you get a piece of paper in 2 years, and then they file a bankruptcy.
Yeah.
And this character has done 200 homes this way. I know of 10 that they have not finished. And I put up a pole barn for $28,000, paid the clown $27,000. He walked off the job. Second guy come in, paid him $42,000 to finish it. And then I had to redo that. I've got over $100,000 in just that pole barn. And I've filed complaints with Attorney General of Iowa, Missouri, and these characters have run up over $250,000 fraudulent work.
Yeah.
There's no justice.
So, Bill, can you give, I don't know if you can give Lee some advice on getting recourse there, but also, you know, how do we avoid, this is terrible, Lee, I'm so sorry that's happened to you.
Yeah, you know, don't even get me started on what you're saying, because I do see that a lot when I'm out traveling, and in fact, we're working with the state fire marshal's office, doing some trainings with builders, and we're going to be doing some on energy efficiency and codes and that. But this, what really makes me mad is it's really hard to hold them liable, because unless you, each time you give them a check, you make sure that you get, for most people, you get lien waivers showing that the materials have been paid. Otherwise, they don't get any money. But the problem is, you sign a contract with somebody, you expect them to hold up to that. But when they are so big sometimes, they're so fast to go bankrupt or change their name. And I know some companies in Iowa, I wish that they would just take them and banish them to some other country where contractors, bad contractors would be sent. I feel really bad for Lee, because this shouldn't happen. Builders should consider it a craft, because they're building for people. I think a lot of builders are just strictly looking at the money, try to make a quick buck, build a piece of junk. Because when I was teaching, I'd tell the kids, the students, if you're not building a house and thinking of the people first and wanting it to last at least 100 years, then get out of my class and go learn how to build garages. Nothing against garages, but that's the limit where they should be building. I feel really bad. And you go to the state attorney generals, you would think, okay, that would handle it. But other than, getting a bunch of lawyers, well, then that's out of your pocket.
Right.
They kind of have you. I really don't have a good answer, because you would think that going to the state attorney general, that would do it. In today's world of, all these websites and like Angie's List and all that, I don't know if anybody really gets on there enough to say, hey, look, they just took me for this amount of money. I would, happen to me, I think with today, I'd have somebody take a whole bunch of pictures and put them online and say, I'm not lying about it. This is exactly
right.
what they did. I don't know if that's legal or
so
not.
So share your story, but hopefully, yeah. and try to do your research before hiring a company. But Lee, that's a terrible situation, and we're really sorry. Here's a question from David in Des Moines. I repaired a floor-to-ceiling crack in the corner of our 1915 home with a flexible patching compound. I opened it up a bit to an inverted V, cleaned it out, pressed the compound in, primed and repainted, followed all the procedures that are supposed to work, and
it opened up.
It reappeared after only a couple of months.
Yeah.
What do you recommend for this repair, and generally for addressing recurring stress cracks in old plaster?
Old plaster is a whole different animal, because each house is different. Sometimes it even depends on which wall that the exterior of the wall is facing, because it could be facing west or south, and the wall, through heat and moisture driven in through wind, the wall can expand and contract. Because if it's an older home, the moisture can come in and it gets on that plaster. And that's one good thing about plaster, is that, moisture can usually go through it. Well, then it does expand and contract, and it's really hard to keep that from happening. There are some fabrics, not really a vinyl, but there are some fabrics that they make to go over the top. It's like a webbing, like the tape that he's talking about, but it covers the whole wall. And then you put a coating over the top of that, so you have kind of a plaster look, but the cracks open and close behind that fabric. You can usually find that on some home renovation sites. And I wish I could remember the name of the product, because we used it in a YWCA probably 40 years ago. And I think that's still holding up. I don't go to the YW very often, but I'm sure somebody would have called me by now. It seems like even drywall in certain cases, like peaks and, on our vaulted ceilings, some people every year they'll say, my ceiling opens up at the top. Well, it's the animal, bit of wood and the cold and warm and moisture that they do make some products, but sometimes they still fail too.
Yeah.
So I would look at something to cover a larger area and actually bridges that crack.
All right. Jenny's on the line next in Winterset. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, I had a question about my foundation. We have an 1898 home with a limestone foundation. It's about 18 to 24 inch thick block. But it seems that whatever the compound is they use in between it, between those block
yeah.
is crumbling out and like yeah. the gaps are getting larger.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, is that normal? Is that going to hold up? Is that something we need to address? And if so, how or what kind of a craftsman deals with limestone foundations like that?
Yeah, usually a mason, a bricklayer in the area can probably help you on that. You know, do you have the kind of the fuzzy efflorescence coming out of it, you know, that it looks like some people think it looks like mold, but it's just a kind of a white fuzz coming out of the joints as well?
I've not noticed that so okay. much. I've just noticed like kind of some dusty crumble kind
sure.
of falling out of it.
Yeah, because limestone's very, very moisture. It holds moisture. It lets moisture travel. It's very permeable. That's kind of how it was formed, you know, just different layers. You have a lot of times they'll use a cement, which is very hard, and then limestone really isn't. And so they'll get expansion, contraction, and it cracks out when they're that thick. You know, structurally, it usually isn't anything, but, you know, there's probably no waterproofing on the outside. And so water will get into the limestone and it comes through to the inside, and then it, you know, you get through expansion and contraction, like that mortar will fall out because it's really hanging on mostly to limestone dust once it gets wet. Most of the time, it's more of a cosmetic issue. And if you do try to tuck point it, which is a term they use for putting mortar in between the stones, it can happen again. I would not waste my time like having somebody come in and put a coat of cement over it, because that will eventually fall off as well. Most of the time, a good mason can make a more of a flexible type of a mortar that specifically for limestone and that. And so it's and some have used like some of the newer types of polymer caulking to put in between for cosmetics as well. Structurally, I really wouldn't worry about it. But it's just kind of like these old homes. It's just one of those things you kind of have to live with. It, you know, do you have is the basement kind of short as well, like maybe only 7 feet tall?
It is. It's only about 6 feet high.
Yeah, yeah. And it's probably a very thin floor, you know, and so there's a ton of moisture. And then that moisture comes up through the stone and keeps the stone wet. So it always smells a little musty down there, doesn't it?
Yep, we run a dehumidifier, and that seems to help. But we have a brick flooring in the basement.
Okay, now, what you may be worth your while, take a look and get a hold of a radon mitigation person, you know, the people that put in the radon mitigation systems to take radon gas out of your basement. One good thing about the radon systems is they pull the radon gas, out from around the underneath the floor and around the foundation. But they also take that moisture vapor, and they're cheaper to run than a dehumidifier. A lot of people will call up the radon guys and say, you know, I can't believe how dry my basement is since we put the radon system in. It's just, you know, and so a lot of people will put that system in strictly to pull the moisture, irregardless of what the radon reading is. And that would also help on the smell. I was just in a basement this week where a guy put one in, and the smell now is completely gone that he had. I know two instances, one in Des Moines and this one South Fort Dodge.
So it's a win-win-win.
Yes, and then plus, you know, if you haven't tested for radon, at least you're getting rid of that as well.
Right. Well, Jenny, thank you so much for your call. We have a lot of people who are calling us to tell us about cool silo projects that they know about.
Oh, there we go. That's
what
we
need. And I would love to spend the rest of the hour talking about
next month.
Projects. Yes, but we will do that another time. I'll read just this one comment from Cheryl in West Union. She says, there's a silo home in Titanka, Iowa. There's an Airbnb silo in Decorah. She's heard plans of a future one in Fayette.
Ooh.
The one in Decorah has a sitting room, bedroom, and bathroom. So I think, Steve, if you get online and you start looking around.
And there's that one, I think it's south and east of Stratford that they had and might have been in the movie Twister, but there's one that is twisted. That is really cool. I wish somebody would call in and say they know which one I'm talking about. But that, I've got some pictures of that one. Now it is so neat.
All right. Well, maybe
twisted silo.
Maybe
boy,
silos are what we talk about next month for sure. A whole business
A brewery.
Plan. All right. 866-780-9100 is the number to call with your questions. Linda has this question. My mom's house has outside steel siding and the paint is peeling off. We need to get the house painted. Are there any special recommendations we need to inquire about when contacting companies to paint a house in this condition?
Yeah, be sure and tell them you do not want it power washed at a high pressure. And some will. They'll say, oh, well, we'll go ahead and take the paint off and everything that way. But all you're doing is blowing that water behind the steel siding, because that is not a water barrier in any sense of the manner. That high-pressure water will get behind the steel. The sun will bake it into the wood behind it, and it'll saturate your walls. So do not let them do that. They can use a lower pressure water, but not high pressure when they aim up. If they aim down, it's a lot better, but it's still not good to do that. They have to use a lower a lower pressure.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Michael is on the line. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
Hi, do you have a question?
Very much enjoying your show, and I just want to say anybody that's not afraid of work should consider repurposing buildings.
Yes. Oh, thank you. Oh, there's my guy.
Endorsement. All right. Yes. Ralph's on the line in Grinnell. Hi, Ralph.
Hi. I've got an older two-story farmhouse. The raccoons are trying to tear a hole through the shingles. Should I put a new metal roof on plus a metal soffit to keep the coons from doing their justice to my house?
That or a live trap and move the tree away. But because I've had that issue before too. But you know, metal roof will help.
And you're a pretty big fan of these steel roofs.
I am. You know, I really am. You put it on and you're done. And I've grown to really like them. I think that they're very good roofs. There's a reason. You know, you got one thing about it. You have to make sure that those coons are out of there. Do it now. Don't do it in the spring, because they may have a family in there, and then you'll have a, you know, real mess.
Right.
I try the live trap first to move them away somewhere else, and then put a metal barrier over the hole or wherever they're getting it in, and then go from there.
And a very bright light often discourages them. Loud radios can discourage them as well.
Or if that's a calling card for feeding them, that's another.
All right. Very quickly, Danielle in Woodward. Hi, Danielle.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. How about the leaf guards for your gutters? Since I followed Bill's recommendation and got a steel roof, I'm no longer comfortable going up there as I used to love to do to clean out the gutters.
Because it's
and
slippery.
I do have some leaf guards now, but they're not keeping the leaves out.
Yeah. I'm not, me personally, I do have a problem with some of the leaf guard systems. There's some other types, you know. It depends on how large is your overhang. Is it about 2 feet or so? Do you know?
It's not that
okay
long.
If you have a leaf guard system now, get back with the manufacturer, the brand that you have, and then call them up and say, hey, you know, all the advertisements say that I'm not supposed to have a problem. Why do I have an issue? And go right from there, and maybe they've come up with a different style that is going to let the leaves go over. There's some alternatives. They're more like a vein instead of a gutter system, but you have to have a larger overhang and a way to get the water away if you don't have gutters and downspouts.
Sure.
But they also have, you know, your leaf blowers have large extensions that you can, real long extensions. You could do it from the ground, and there's also some for hoses that will reach way up there and blow the leaves out. I like the leaf blower one myself.
All right.
That may do it for you.
All right. Although good instincts about not wanting to fall off the roof.
Yes. That's very painful. Knocks
the
wind out of you.
Danielle. All right. We are out of time. But thank you so much to everybody who called and wrote in questions today. Bill McAnally, thank you very much.
Yes. And Silos next month. This is going to be great.
All right. Bill McAnally, our home improvement expert. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. We had production assistance today from Stephanie Nobrega. And of course, you can listen to Talk of Iowa anytime on our podcast. Subscribe anywhere you get your podcast. Just search for Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbie.